reminder that you can help save Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's home in Hindhead, Surrey, by supporting the Undershaw Preservation Trust. It was at Undershaw that he wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Return of Sherlock Holmes, and entertained many notable people, including Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, J.M. Barrie, the creator of Peter Pan, and the young Virginia Woolf. Today, Undershaw stands sorrowfully empty, neglected, and vandalized. Waverly Borough Council have granted the owners planning permission to carve up the literary historic house into three flats, with five more homes built on its side. Modern townhouses, or maintained as the single dwelling that Conan Doyle designed and had built. The Undershaw Preservation Trust is vigorously working towards the latter, and you can help by visiting www.saveundershaw.com, as well as following them on Twitter and joining their Facebook campaign. Thank you.
Want to know whose birthday it is? Follow at MegaBirthday on Twitter. Keep up on all of your favorite birthdays, whether it be musicians, actors, historical people, people in politics. Who knows? It could be anyone. You can also check them out at www.megabirthdaysite.com.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Baker Street Babes podcast. Tonight we're looking, today, whichever time of day it is, we're looking at the women in Sherlock Holmes. Sadly, Cappers can't be with us today because she has useless siblings who can't feed themselves.
Yeah.
But
I'm bitter.
I'm obviously here. Hi, I'm Artie, and Curly is here and Jen is here as well.
Hello!
One day we will actually get a podcast where we're all here. I don't know which episode it will be, but one day. But
if it ever happens, the universe is going to explode or something.
I don't think wherever we meet could handle all of us in the same place at the same time.
This is true. Things would happen and it would be... Yeah! Okay. So, the women in Sherlock Holmes... There's obviously quite a few of them, but they never really get featured other than Adler, which she actually doesn't appear that often even. So.
And by that often, you mean once.
Yes. She's alluded to in other stories, isn't she?
Yeah, she gets mentioned. She's the only male character that gets mentioned in more than one story.
She's got that.
Well, so, wait, what about Watson's wife?
Oh, well, does she count?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I would hope she counts.
Yeah, she does. No, sorry.
Which wife? He gets married twice, doesn't he?
I think both of them.
Well, there's a dispute about that, but yeah.
Oh, dispute. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, but that's for, you know, the proper hardcore Sherlockians to handle. I'm not getting into that.
If it was just an error or... It's all very serious things. Okay, so we had people send in questions because... That's the cool thing to do.
We're cool like that.
We're so cool because we can't think of our own questions. And you guys have some, which you did. Some of them are very similar.
Can we tackle Trudy's first? Because I feel like we need to get the most serious one out of the way first so we can have fun after that.
Yes. So Trudy, who is on episode 3, she asked on Twitter, how do Arthur Conan Doyle's female characters differ from portrayals of women in other 19th century fiction? And Artie has graciously decided to tackle this one because I was just cursing her for making us do research. So I'm going to let you go and do magical things with that.
Not so magical, because the thing is, if you ask how do they differ from other Victorian fiction, the answer is very simple in that it is probably not so much. which is the short version of the answer, but obviously that's not really, you know, proper discussion, and not a proper serious answer to a serious, serious question. I had a bit of a look at just, well, I flicked through the stories, looked at the female characters with a bit of a background of, what the situation of women was in Victorian society. And it's something that you could just, you know, talk about for hours on end, because once you get going, you just don't stop, because there's these several, there's not just women and men, there's also the social classes, which are way, the society's way more class structure than it is today. And there's all sorts of changes going on. Also, you want to bear in mind, the stories were written over a period of 40 years. The first was published in 1887, the last in 1927. And in setting, they're between 1880 and 1914. So that's 35. That is a lot of time. And it is around a time where society changes a lot, because basically we're at the end of the Victorian period. You know, modernism is knocking at the door, but it's not quite there. And you've got this gradual change in society going on. Amongst other things, the perception of women, the role that women were supposed to have, and that is reflected in the literature of the time. Now, if you look at the stories with that in mind, there was the ideal of the woman being the angel in the house, which is so yeah, the angel in the house. Anyway, you know, women were pretty much defined as wives and mothers, you know, their father's daughters on occasion, and there was this domestic ideal. I'm not quite sure how that ties into the class structure, because by the time the stories were written, like, the canon is populated with servant girls, for example, who obviously can't have this domestic ideal going for them because they work for other people, they get their hands dirty. But the ideal for a middle or an upper class woman was the domestic goddess, the angel in the house, if you want.
A lady.
Yeah, just pure and clean and ideally untroubled by sexual desire. And towards the end of the century, that perception changes. People start challenging it, like, women start challenging it, but also men in literature start challenging it and start realizing how restrictive it is. For example, in legal terms, you have the situation of women. They were basically, if they got married, they were the property of their husbands. Any income they had, any property they had, belonged to the husbands. They couldn't do anything legally. They needed their husband's consent for anything, you know, opening a bank account, entering a contract, what have you. And Arthur Conan Doyle, funnily enough, was involved in legal reform, particularly in divorce law reform, because it was very, very hard for a woman to divorce her husband. There's two stories that deal with that, which is a case of identity, where a woman comes to him because she's misplaced her fiancé.
Misplaced her fiancé.
I saw him the other day. I put him down on the counter, but I just don't know where he got to.
Yeah, literally it is like that. He gets in a carriage to the church where they're going to get married, and the carriage gets there at the event, but he's not in it. She's sworn to him that she'll always be true to him, and it turned out that the person who she thought was her fiancé is in fact her stepfather, and he did this to prevent her from getting married, to keep his hands on her money.
Oh, that's right. I remember that story now.
Yep.
And the other case, the other story that deals with a violent husband is the Abbey Grange. That deals with divorce laws, basically, and the Lady Brackenstall, actually, in that. When you read criticism of the stories, very often people say, you know, women don't have a face, they don't have a voice in these stories, they stay silent, they stay on the margins. Lady Brackenstall actually gets a voice, and she gets to tell her story, and she says, because basically her husband is found dead in the house, and one of the first things she says to Holmes is, well, I'm the wife, we were married for a year, and it's not a secret that our marriage was not happy. He was a drunkard and he beat me. And at the time, domestic abuse was a serious problem. There are essays from the time that say, you know, if you go into a London hospital on a Saturday night, what you will find in what we would today say is the A&E, will find women who've been beaten up by their husbands. And it was very, very hard for women to leave their husbands with the divorce laws that were in place, because you had to prove adultery and also cruelty or sodomy or, you know, something else. Whereas for men to divorce women, they had to prove that the woman had been adulterous and they could divorce her. So there was a massive double standard in place. And Arthur Conan Doyle was heavily involved in divorce law reform. So I think it's not exactly fair to look at the story from today's point of view and go, yeah, he was a bit sexist, wasn't he? Yeah, but then also, which is true, you know, if you look at it from today's point of view, but also you have to take him as a bit of a child of his time, and for yeah. of his time, he was quite progressive in his opinion of women and in his attitude towards women's rights. So that's the kind of background that I'm working from. And if you look at it closely, you actually get all sorts of different women in the stories, and people seem to concentrate sometimes on the fact that women are on the margins, or that, you know, women are maybe not very bright, but there's men in the canon who are stupid.
The redheaded league.
And actually, the first story that was published, Scandal in Bohemia, the first short story after Studying Scarlet, features Irene Adler, who is reasonably, you know, independent, a bit mysterious, but she is the one woman that Sherlock Holmes, the eternal misogynist, ends up respecting. We've got some damsels in distress. Mrs. St. Clair in The Man with the Twisted Lip, who comes to Holmes because, again, she's misplaced her husband.
You know, there's actually two women in distress in that story, because Watson gets up in the middle of the night to go help a friend who's in the dens, and then he finds Sherlock there, realizing he's helping another woman who's in distress.
Yes, true, yeah. You've also got females that are somewhat stronger. The wives in Second Stain and in Naval Treaty, for example, who, you know, look after their husbands, but also act for their husbands, interact with Holmes for their husbands, you know, because their husbands are too weak to do it. You have the treatment of what I was talking about earlier about domestic abuse. For instance, Helen Stoner in Speckled Band, and Holmes calls her on it. She comes to him and tells him this story, and then she wants to go. She's got her hand on the doorknob, and Holmes says, "You've forgotten to tell me something." And he just grabs her by the wrist, and you can see a bruise on her arm. And he says, "You are shielding your stepfather." And apart from Irene Adler, I think there's other really strong women in the canon. My favorite personally is probably Miss Hunter in The Copper Beeches, and also the girl in The Solitary Cyclist.
Yeah, definitely, both of them.
Yeah, because those are middle-class women who are working. And that is, at the time, becoming more and more common, that women are actually working outside of their own homes. You know, I mean, as governesses, or one of the professions that were acceptable, but at least, you know, not defined as a mother and wife. There are different types of women in there, and I wouldn't say that they're silent, that they don't get to tell their stories, that they don't get a voice.
Definitely not, because the one that first jumped to my mind was Mrs. Stapleton in Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh,
she
yeah.
makes like a concerted effort to like try and protect them, and like she ends up like going back to like the domestic abuse thing. She ends up being like hurt because of it.
Right? Yeah,
she's a very strong woman. I really liked her. As opposed yeah, to, like, okay. Laura Lyons is kind of like, meh.
Yeah, and also Charles Augustus Milverton.
Yes.
The person who kills the criminal is one of his victims. And Holmes and Watson witness the killing. You know, they make sure that she gets away with it, because it was damn well the right thing to do, because he ruined so many lives. And, you know, she is silent. She doesn't even get a name. She doesn't get a face, but she's completely vital to the story. So whichever way you look at it, you can look at it from a negative point of view and say, well, the plot hinges on her, but she doesn't even get proper representation. Or you can go, well, she doesn't even have a name, but she's a fucking bamf. It depends a bit on, you know, where you're standing, where you're coming from. To go back to the original question, how do they differ from women in other Victorian literature? I think it's very difficult to even make that comparison, because many of these short stories, and they're written over a period of time, whereas a big genre of Victorian literature actually is the novel, and to contrast these short stories with novels is kind of a bit like apples and pears, if you see what I mean. I'd say that generally perhaps there is an awareness that there are social problems and that, you know, that there are problems that affect women and that are dealt with in these stories, that are dealt with in other literature of the period as well. I mean, you know, Dickens,
right.
The big one, certainly deals with it. There are female heroines in the literature of the time. A personal favourite, again, of mine is Mrs. Gaskell's Mary Barton. She's a female working class heroine, an ordinary person who ends up doing extraordinary things.
It sounds like a Hallmark card.
it sounds a bit cheesy, but it is... And she does it to save the guy that she loves, which is almost a bit like a gender swapped version of a traditional pattern, but I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't go so far, but she certainly kicks some ass. And, one other very, very prominent female character in literature at the time, 1891, Hardy published Tess of D'Urbervilles.
Oh my god, that story rips my heart out and stamps on it and sets it on fire.
Yeah, and I mean, that, you know, properly dealing with everything that is bad for women around, basically.
No, Tess is, like, how did Hardy describe, like, story of like one true woman or something like that.
Yeah.
Like she does everything in like good conscience and as like a proper lady should, and she just gets taken advantage of and then warped and I'm so eloquent, I feel like no things.
What I'd say they have in common is there's an awareness that there's a problem there that probably needs solving. So that would be my long-winded not really answered to the question, because I do find it a difficult question to answer, and I have some knowledge of Victorian literature, but obviously
I was actually going to add that the two stories that Artie mentioned, The Copper Beeches and The Solitary Cyclist, it's a really good example of female intuition, you know, that Arthur Conan Doyle based the entire idea of these women are in a position where they're thinking, there's something going on here. I don't know what it is. I need to ask for somebody's opinion. And I feel that that's a really great portrayal of the idea of female intuition, because, you know, sometimes I don't want to generalize, but sometimes, you know, you get this idea that men don't always pick up on what's going on around them.
Mm-hmm.
And women, and I feel like especially at that time, because women were in a more submissive position as ladies or housekeepers, so they were more observers.
Yes.
Yes.
And
professional people watchers.
Right, exactly. I mean, in essence, what else were they going to do if they weren't working? You know, they were looking at the people around them, or because they were working for the higher. I love, you know, like the whole Downton Abbey and upstairs, downstairs, because you get all these people that are just, their job is to serve them, but at the same time, they're gossiping. They know what's going on.
They see so much.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I think that, you know, The Copper Beeches and The Solitary Cyclist are really good examples of women realizing there's something that's not right here. And then to go forward and to go to Sherlock Holmes. And I think Sherlock Holmes was aware of that too, because they're like, this is really interesting. And obviously it was interesting enough to get Sherlock involved, and it wasn't boring or anything.
Yeah. Something that's also quite significant is at one side, you've got to, on one hand, you've got to look at how the women are portrayed. But on the other hand, I always find it interesting to see how they're treated by other characters and Holmes.
Yeah, that's definitely a really good point.
You know, the way that Holmes is with these women. I mean, even if he always says, oh, you know, what's in the fair sex is your department, and what have you. Always polite, courteous. He listens, you know, when probably other people don't, or they have no one else to go to. He doesn't necessarily judge. I mean, Holmes's perception of justice is another podcast in and of itself. But, you know, for example, something like this woman kills this criminal and he makes sure she gets away with it. For instance, in the illustrious client, there's the former mistress, Kitty Winter, who comes to him.
Winter sounds like a Bond girl.
Yeah, but, and, you know, she's been ostracized by society because she was this guy's mistress, and he's disfigured her, and she can never go back into polite society through no fault of her own, and Holmes has nothing but compassion for her. Like, he doesn't judge.
And that's something perhaps that I find quite significant.
I wonder if that has anything to do, because I know that, you know, you've got to take the stories, you know, as they were published. I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that the scandal in Bohemia happened so soon after studying Scarlet and Sign of Four, that maybe Holmes's perception of women changed. Because, I mean, that's probably going out on a limb and reading way more into it than Arthur Conan Doyle intended. But if you think about it, because he's, the Sign of Four is, yeah, you've got Mary Morstan, but it's told from Watson's perspective. So you get Watson's feel of, you know, how he admires this woman, and Sherlock's so much more interested in figuring out what's going on versus dealing with the woman. He kind of sends Watson off with Mary so that he can get on with his work. But the scandal in Bohemia happens. He realizes he's just been outsmarted by a woman. He starts to obviously be a gentleman, which of that period of time, a person I would think of Sherlock's standard and class would be a gentleman anyway.
Yeah.
That he actually starts to realize that women either see more or know more, or there is something to women that he should pay closer attention to.
That is a good point, actually. I mean, you get that whole development in Charles Augustus Milverton, because he gets engaged to Milverton's housemaid. And Watson's completely outraged, because, like, Holmes is just so unethical, thus just so immoral, and Holmes is like, well, the ends justify the means, you know? And then this other woman shows up and kills the criminal, and I think he genuinely felt remorse for what he did to that poor housemaid. But, you know, again, that's speculation. But that is an example of a woman who was treated really, really badly by Holmes. But to my knowledge, that's the only time in the canon that something like that happened, where he's like actually openly doing something that's something to a woman that's not entirely ethical, shall we say.
I think it's in The Sign of Four when he says, like, I would not tell them too much. Women are never entirely to be trusted, not the best of them. So
yeah,
he is like, his respect does grow for women, because he's like, women can be very intelligent and you shouldn't trust them because they will outsmart you.
That reminds me of those old World War II posters that yes. You just be able to keep mum, she's not so dumb.
Yes. I don't know which story it's in, but it's Holmes talking about, like, the motives of women. And he's like, how can you build on such quicksand? Like, the trivial actions may mean volumes, and their, like, conduct may depend on, like, a hairpin. So there's things that he doesn't quite understand about them, because just the minds just work very differently, like, biologically and everything. So he's like, you can't trust them because they think differently than I do, and they can outsmart me now. It's freaking me out, man.
Well, you know, we're kind of, you know, we're discussing all these women here, and I think this actually goes into another question that we got. Lovely transition, thank you.
Segue!
Yay! I'm a professional, people. It's from Twitter. Dr. Raoul Duke, I believe that's how you pronounce it, asked, didn't all the women in Sherlock Holmes fall in love with bad men who then moved to Australia, South African diamond mines?
Obviously not.
Because we've obviously been talking about that. But I think that that's a huge generalization. But yes, South Africa and Australia came up a lot in that times. But I think that has to do with the period, though, doesn't it? I mean, because that was the whole British Empire still kind of
growing.
That's where you went. You went to Australia, you went to South Africa.
Yeah, and obviously there's lots of movement to Australia, criminal-wise, but there's also, like, sort of, like, this new, well, obviously colony, but, like, it's this new Britain that's growing, and it's warm there, so you should go there. It's very exciting and very exotic, because it was, like, you could travel a bit more easier than you could before. So these places were actually a bit more in reach if you had the money to do so. So it was obviously very romantic about it, going off to be whisked away to these tropical locations with a bad man.
Well, they didn't always go there, though. There were a few that went to the U.S.
Yes, which is not quite as tropical and romantic.
Depending on where in the U.S. you live.
It's true.
Yeah, or you get a woman who comes to England from Australia, like Lady Brackenstall in Abbey Grange. She grew up in Australia and fell in love with a good man on the ship, but married a bad man.
Poor girl.
Yeah, but he came to save her. And again, Holmes let both of them get away with it because, you know, it was evidently an unacceptable thing to do to kill the guy who beats up a woman.
He tested him too and said, yes. you know, this is what's going to happen. And he said, absolutely not. I will go down for all of this. This will not be her fault. And he goes, you really love her. All right, go.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, they do the whole trial thing, don't they? With Watson as the jury and Holmes as the judge. I love that story a lot.
I don't think I've read that one.
It's a good
one. Granada adaptation is wonderful.
Oh, Jeremy Brett.
Yeah, but also the guy who plays the sailor.
Oh yeah, he was really good.
Oh my god, she's my heart.
So I think we've answered the question. Not all the baddies move off to Australia or South Africa.
No.
Sometimes they come from there.
And sometimes they die. Yeah. I think maybe before we move on to another question, we should, I guess, talk about Adler, because I feel we may be killed if we don't.
Yeah, we have kind of glazed over her a little bit.
But because, like, everyone makes such a big deal about her, but she is only in the one story, and then she's, like, mentioned in others, but she only appears in one. She just made a very profound, like, effect, because she's the woman. And I think you guys would probably join me in saying, not in a romantic way, but
yeah,
I respect you, you outsmarted me, you are awesome.
Yeah.
Because Holmes says, and I think it's The Adventure of the Devil's Foot, like, I have never loved. So it's like, well, that is him saying it. He hasn't loved a woman. So he hasn't loved Adler. He just respects her. It's really cool.
It's an admiration.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's my favorite word to use when it comes to the two of them. The relationship between Sherlock and Irene, it's of that of admiration. And I think she admires him just as much as he admires her. But clearly she's not in love with him because she goes off and she marries and she moves away. So, end of story.
Yeah. She marries multiple times, doesn't she?
There's one line that just sums it up for me where they go to the house and, you know, the bird's flown and they find the photo and everything. And the king says something like, oh, what a pity she wasn't of my league, or she wasn't on my level or something like that. And Holmes just looks at him and goes, yeah, indeed, she was on a very different level than you, you know, and he obviously meant, you know, she wasn't socially appropriate, and Holmes is talking about something completely different, and the king just does not get it. But that's just kind of his, like Jen said, his admiration and complete respect for this woman just sums it up in those two lines in that exchange, I think.
Well, she's such an interesting woman without the whole scandal behind it. I mean, here she is, she works as an opera singer, and she somehow gets into the good graces of the King of Bohemia.
Like you do.
I mean, who does that?
I've been out there.
And right, exactly. And then, you know, and not only is she in the good graces with him, but she's able to convince him to, you know, take this photograph, which clearly he shouldn't be doing to begin with, because it's going to lead, you know, there's insinuations behind it, and it's not going to be good for his kinglyship. I'm not awake. Forgive me for my poor words. But I mean, here she is. And then, you know, she's worldly. She's American. She's, you know, clearly been on mainland Europe. She's living in London, and she's just a fascinating woman to begin with.
He is.
Without even having this scandal that, you know, Sherlock even gets involved. Obviously, you could tell from my love of Irene Adler.
I adore Adler as well. She's just such a fantastic woman, and she carries herself. She's very sure of herself, which I think is disarming to, like, everyone, like, in that era and in the story. And then at the end of the day, Sherlock wants to remember her, so he keeps a photograph of her.
Yes.
I really love the Granada series episode. I thought really, really, really well. And you also get a bit more of a look at how Sherlock might have gone about keeping his eye on Irene. That's, you know, obviously in the TV adaptation, that's not in the story, because the stories are told from Watson's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest disappointment when it comes to Irene Adler is that's the only story that you get of her. in all honesty, I think, in and of herself, she would make an amazing literary character to follow. She's having all these awesome adventures. I want her life, you know?
There are series of pastiches that might interest you.
Are there? Ooh,
yes, there's Irene Adler novels.
Really?
Yes.
I'm going to have to check those out.
I'm going to look them up, and I'll put a link to the author and the novels on the website for anyone who's listening and also loves Irene Adler.
Yay!
Yay!
Oh, I had a thought, and then it went away. Okay. I'm on Wikipedia, and I'm just looking, like, in what other stories, like, she's referenced, and she's referenced in A Case of Identity, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, and His Last Bow, and maybe in The Five Orange Pips, because Holmes mentions that he's been beaten 4 times, but she's never named, so I don't know, but she may be featured in The Five Orange Pips.
Yeah.
She's clearly left an impression.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
An American impression. Bah-ha-ha-ha-ha.
We do tend to do that, don't we?
We do.
You do indeed.
It's not always good, but we leave an impression.
I wonder why, well, maybe not wonder so much, but the conscious choice to make Irene American as opposed to British. Like, does that make her, like, it's a strong word, but, like, more exotic?
What I was going to say.
Yeah.
I also wonder if it has something to do with the period of time, because I also, as Artie was saying earlier about the role of women at that time, women had a different role, I think. I don't want to go too far and say totally different, but I think women were also, could be a lot more independent in the States at that time.
Yes,
with that. Could be in Britain. And that might, I wonder if that might have had something to do with it too, as well as the whole exotic aspect of it as well.
Yeah, because it's post-Civil War. The country has changed quite a bit.
Yeah, so basically feminism is just a bit more advanced in the States, and Britain, or whatever you want to call it, is still dragging its feet a bit in that respect.
It's sort of still the austere British Empire.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, America that's like, we're building shit and doing things. I am so damn eloquent.
But no, Christina, you bring up a really, really great point at that time that was this huge reconstruction going on in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because it's post-Civil War and we've basically, you know, ruined so much. And, you know, it was the country coming back together and working together, you know, the expansion of the railroads and everything. Also, too, so many men were lost during the Civil War.
Yes.
Women had to step up into it, you know, into a more leading position. So if they lost not only their husbands and perhaps even all their sons, they were the only ones left behind, and they had to run the household at that point. And I also think there was more of an opportunity for women in the States at that time to be able to run their own household if need be. Mm. It may not have been, you know, they may have been the talk of the town if that was the case, but I feel that they were also in a better position where they could do that.
Yeah, especially in the cities where women could actually go and get jobs and, like, provide. Because, you know, yeah, the Civil War decimated the male population.
Right.
And then there's also all the move out west as well. Whole other ballpark. Westward expansion.
Right. But, I mean, bringing that back to Irene Adler, I think I think all of those kind of play into going on. I don't know the history of Arthur Conan Doyle and the U.S., if he had any sort of relations with the U.S. or knew what was going on over there. I would assume that news got back to England about things that were going on.
Like, oh, look, they're beating each other up. I guess that can lead into various questions that we have about Irene. Okay, so by various, I mean kind of one. Because most of the questions that we got were for BBC Sherlock series, as opposed to the canon. Which I think we've covered the canon pretty well. So obviously Sherlock series 2 is coming out, and they're doing Scandal in Bohemia, aka Scandal in Bigger Area. And we still don't know who's playing Irene Adler. I suspect we won't know unless people, when they're going to the sets, still find these things out. We won't know who's playing Irene. Brianna Lauren on Twitter asked us, which actress is best for Irene Adler in BBC Sherlock? I've heard some opinions, would love to hear more. Obviously, she's already cast, so whatever we say may not actually matter.
Well, we hope she's been cast. I mean, clearly, Stephen's finally finished the script.
Yes, finally. Because he's working on Doctor Who now, which means Sherlock is done. I guess I don't have a very strong opinion. I just want her to be played by an American actress, because I know people can do accents, but it just annoys me when there's obviously, we have a lot of actresses over here. And some of them are quite good. And it would be useful to actually use an American actress who already has that sort of ingrained, like, American, like, pluckiness in her, as opposed to nothing against Steven or anyone, but when they write American actors, you can tell it's a British person writing what they think an American actually is. And so I want her to actually be played by an American actress. That's my only thing. It probably won't happen, but that's all I want.
I'm actually one person, and I've talked to a friend about this, and the one person I can picture in it, unfortunately, is not American.
God damn it, Jen!
I'm sorry! I think Rebecca Hall would be a good choice. She's kind of got an otherworldly look about her. And I think, and she can do an American accent, a poor Bostonian one in The Town, but she can do an American accent.
Jazzy.
Yeah. I think that would work. I'm not opposed to your idea about, you know, having it be an American actress. I just don't want it to be a stereotypical who people think is a popular American actress. I think
no, I want it to be a good one.
Yeah. as opposed to most of them who make a career here. I guess my idea of Irene is kind of sketchy, and only because I have this idea of who her looks, I guess is what I mean when I say that I have an idea that it's sketchy. All I really, really care about is that she gets the character right.
Yes.
Yeah. To me, it doesn't matter what she looks like, but I would hope that she's got some sort of otherworldly look about her, but that she's got all those characteristics of Irene Adler that makes Irene Adler who she is. So that's my big thing.
I don't really have a casting choice either. And I second Christina in saying that I really would love to see an American playing her. Perhaps because of House, I'm a bit skewed in saying if she was a couple years younger, then Lisa Edelstein would have made an absolutely brilliant Irene Adler. But what I really care about and what I'm really, really so nervous about, but I think the Moth is trolling us with this, is that he said it's a twisted love story. And I just do not want them to make her a love interest at all, because that is just not right. So as long as that doesn't happen, I'll be okay.
Yeah, I'm with Christine. I don't think he will. And part of the reason why that is that when I think of Stephen Moffat writing Irene Adler, I think she's going to have a lot of the same qualities as River Song does from Doctor Who.
And that would be good awesome, because River is awesome.
I mean, minus the whole, you know, River and the Doctor, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pushing that aside, I think that, you know, you basically, he's going to be writing this BAMF of a woman who I can see, you know, being kind of coy and flirtatious in that sort of River Song way, but also being the one in the room who's going to do the action, who has absolutely no problem pulling out a gun and killing an alien if she needs to. Clearly, that's not going to happen to Sherlock, but...
I don't know, maybe.
Perhaps Rory will come back and die too. But I think, and I know a lot of people were kind of skeptical of, you know, Stephen Moffat being the one who's going to be writing that story, this whole, you know, the whole twisted love story aspect of it. I don't think that's going to be the case. And because of his writing of River Song that reassures me that that won't be the case. So that's my feeling on that. And of course, if it happens and you guys can all call me on it later, but I honestly don't think that that's going to happen. Yeah.
And also, like, the idea of the twisted love story could just be in reference to the actual story. Like, I don't know what they're going to do with that adaptation, but, like, the King of Bohemia sort of being in love with Adler, but not quite, and her being in love with her husband, and then there's the admiration going on. So that's twisted in itself. There's lots of emotions running around.
Right, exactly.
So it could just be in reference to, like, the actual canon, and he is just saying that to make everyone flip a shit.
Yeah.
This is entirely plausible.
No, I definitely think he's trolling up with this. I have faith.
Don't let us down, Muppet.
But, you know, and that's also getting people talking, though, which is when you get people talking, they want to see it when it comes out. And it being the first episode, too, I think that was probably also a way of getting people interested.
You know,
may have been like, all right, I'm done. No, you're not, because this is what's going to be happening. Or is it?
I guess we can kind of go off like that. And it's not really fair to just pin it all on Stephen Moffat, because, you know, other people do write these stories for the BBC adaptation. But we had two questions, one from Nit Merwen and Carnival of the Random, pretty much asking the same thing about why are the female characters in BBC Sherlock sketchily written or thinly drawn. I guess maybe I'll read the whole thing because it is quite a good question. Women have been relegated to a handful of lines, victimhood, mildly subverted by General Shan, Sula, and Sarah, Amanda, and the Blind Banker, each of whom acts in either a self-determined or heroic way. I can talk. Sally Donovan has yet to be fleshed out. Anthea has potential, but is an enigma thus far, and Mrs. Hudson is a delightful yet slightly panther figure. The women of Sherlock Holmes will often be reduced to Irene, Mary, and Mrs. Hudson, but there are a lot more women in Sherlock who are barely more than window dressing. While this is a natural, given the driving relationship is Holmes-Watson, could Moffat and Gatiss do more? The more complex and authentic roles for women in the show thus far are Lucy, Lauren Christ, who did the He Was My Good Man in The Great Game, Hayden Gwynn's Mrs. Wenceslas, and Alison Lintott as Alex Woodbridge's flatmate.
You know, we haven't even discussed Mrs. Hudson yet.
I forgot Mrs. Hudson.
I feel horrible.
I love Mrs. Hudson.
Oh, and it's not even just Una Stubbs portraying Mrs. Hudson. I think Mrs. Hudson's just a fun character.
She is fantastic. Like, the stuff she puts up with is just like, but she has such like a love and like caring for these guys. Aw, Mrs. Hudson.
Yeah, I mean, what's the actress's name from the Granada show?
Oh.
She's just incredible.
Oh, I can't believe we forgot Mrs. Hudson.
Very good. Yeah. But we have her now. We're talking about her now.
Okay. I think it's so difficult, first of all, to hash out minor characters, which, for the most part, women have been relegated to in this series, obviously because the show is driven by the relationship between Holmes and Watson and the cases that they do. It's hard to flesh out women and flesh out characters, period, in such a short amount of time. I mean, even if you look at it from the male perspective, Anderson's not fleshed out. Lestrade's not fleshed out very much right now. There's so many other characters that have just not been fleshed out. That's my, I mean, because it's only been three episodes, 90 minutes long apiece, and that's roughly 80 pages. And
you know, for everyone.
Yes, I took, you know, a script writing course in college. Leave me alone. That it's tough. To, especially when you've got to put in a whole complex plot.
Yeah.
You know, as, you know, something as complex as The Great Game or, you know, to fit in everything in The Study in Pink. You know, not only are you fitting in what's going on, but you're also having to fit in Watson and Holmes meeting for the first time and deciding to become flatmates.
Yeah, and like, I think people forget that it's only like three episodes because it feels like so much more.
Yeah, they crammed a lot in there.
Because they are feature length, so. They're kind of like movies and stuff. But even like Justin studying Pink, they haven't fleshed out Sherlock and John. Like, you have to keep going and going and going.
So right.
It's hard to do that to supporting characters. And I think in the Blind Banker's defense, I like Sarah, and I think she is fleshed out more than people think, because you see her, like, she is a professional. She takes the slack for when John falls asleep. So she's a doctor. She works hard, and then she's awesome because then she, you know, she beats people with sticks. And then, of course, she does get relegated to sort of damsel in distress. You know, move the chair over so you fall down, but we won't.
That was just such a bad decision story-wise, just because you built this woman up, this woman, this character up so much over half of the episode. When I was watching it, when it was on air, I was like, oh my goodness, a good female character. And then, you know, she gets to be the damsel in distress, and I'm just like, what? It really, really rubs me the wrong way, because it's just not, I don't know, I think she would be more resourceful than that.
Yeah, I mean, there's the fact of, like, maybe being paralyzed by fear. Okay, I can get that. You do have this giant thing poking at you that will make you hurt a great deal if it actually hits you.
And I think, you know, it's also worth mentioning, too, that she wasn't the only one who was in distress.
Yes.
John was sitting right there next to her with a gun pointed to his head.
Yes. Yeah, but then he did awesome stuff, and then he said, well, don't worry, the next day isn't going to be like that. And I just cringe every time I hear it, because I'm like, dude, are you really sure she wants to go on another date with
I think it is the cheekiest line ever, and I love it. I hope that she will be used more in series 2. I think she will, because she's returning for series 2.
Well, and also, Vignette Robinson's coming back as Sally Donovan.
Yes.
I think it's great that there is at least one female detective.
Or no, yeah.
she's a sergeant, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, she's at least there. Although, I really hope that we get past the whole freak thing, and that she can contribute a bit more to what's going on. Because, I mean, you're introduced to her brilliantly as this woman who's controlling the press conference and the study in pink. She's the one who's leaning over and explaining to her boss, that's the Daily Mirror, you might not want to be so flippant about your remarks right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she obviously is a female who can be in control. I would love to see if, you know, she could step, if her character steps it up a bit and, you know, finds a way of getting past whatever problem she has with Sherlock. Because I think that there is, you know, a lot more potential there.
Yeah, I was also talking to someone about this, and they said that Sally and John could be allies if they ever had a proper conversation.
Ooh.
And I think that is very true. I think that is frighteningly true. Ooh. And I think that's really interesting.
I've never even thought about that before.
It makes sense, though.
It does. No, it very much does. Moving on to some of the other ones, I don't know if I totally agree with the idea of, you know, Mrs. Hudson is delightful yet slightly panto.
No, she is charming and adorable.
I would totally agree with that.
Yeah.
But especially the whole not your housekeeper line. I think that's great. I mean, clearly this woman's got, you know, some chutzpah behind her. She's looking at him going, I'm not going to clean up after you. Go get your own groceries.
Yeah. What did you do to my wall?
But she's also a very caring character, too, because, I mean, you know, in The Blind Banker, she brings up this tray of, you know, treats for John. It's like, I'm sorry, I don't have a whole lot going on, but here's a little bit for your date, you know? So she genuinely cares about these two, but I also think that, you know, she's going to look at him and say, you are two grown men. Clean up after yourselves. And I honestly think that she does have the capability of doing that. Is she a little, how shall we say, a little whimsical in her, just in a polite manner? I mean, that whole exchange between her and Lestrade about.
I was just about to say that.
Here she is in a moment. Sherlock's doing a case. She knows who the victim is. She watches the show. She knows what this is all about, and she's sharing her wisdom. It may not be relevant to the case. But she's like, she teaches you how to do your colors. What the hell does that mean?
I just thought that Lestrade actually, like, engages her in this conversation. Like, that is a brilliant little bit of dialogue right there.
And I think Una and Rupert Graves really play that well.
Yes.
You know, that here's this woman who's just, she's a sweet, sweet old woman, but God, she's a little baddie, isn't she?
Yes. But she still obviously cares so much about these boys. I call them boys because they act like boys. When the Sunny Pink, like, they come in and she's like crying, she's like, what have you done? Like, probably one, because she's terrified there's a bunch of police officers in her house. It's like, what have you done now, young man? Are you going to cause me more heartache already?
Well, I also think Mrs. Hudson kind of plays, there needs to be a mother figure.
Yes.
Because clearly John and Sherlock need a mother figure in their lives.
Too.
Especially with all the craziness that they get up with. I mean, even in the Granada series, you know, Mrs. Hudson is kind of like, she's the constant. She's there.
Yeah,
she's,
yeah.
You know, when they come back, she is going to be there. And I mean, obviously in the Granada version, she plays the landlady. So she is sort of taking care of them.
Or you mean?
Right, yeah. Or yeah, the house. But she's always there. She's a constant. And I think that that gives her a bit of power that people aren't looking into. Because being the constant in a story, it's going to be, I think later on, she's going to become a bigger character in that. She's always around. And I think that eventually she is going to be someone who can either help them or save them in a way.
Mm-hmm. And she's someone that Sherlock and John care about, especially I think Sherlock, because they have this history. We don't quite know what it is in the BBC version, as opposed to him making sure her husband was executed. But
that's a good friend.
Yes, yes. That also very close.
Just back to domestic abuse.
Yeah.
Look at that circle we just made.
Okay. Well, the one female character in the BBC version that I've seen a lot of controversy about is Molly, because you know there's those who say, "My God, she's such a mouse. She's just, you know, a female character that just should not be on television." And there's those who say, actually, A, there's probably more to her than you can see, and B, it is possible to be, you know, an intelligent person with obviously some kind of medical degree. You know, she, I don't know what the English word is, forensic pathologist, is that the one? Clearly, you know, a smart, competent person, yet have a crush on someone that absolutely reduces you to just gibbering. And take it from one who has been there, yes, it's entirely possible. Like,
it is.
Well, yeah, I've
a realistic character in that respect. So I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that, you know, she's poorly written. I don't think she is. She just doesn't get a lot of lines, but that's, as Jen just said, it is difficult to flesh out minor characters if you have so little time, and if you are putting so much story in so little time.
You know, the only thing that slightly bothers me about Molly is that it's her lack of intuition. And I feel like that she has trouble picking up on other cues that people give her. I mean, she goes out with Jim from IT. Is Moriarty really that good that she couldn't pick up on it? Or is it just that she missed, you know, what's going on? Or is it because she looks stupid, quote unquote stupid, because she's up against Sherlock, who is, you know, this huge, you know, he does the science of deduction.
Like, I forget, I think it was in the first episode that we talked about the companion blogs to the series. And Molly, she gets reduced to like this gibbering idiot, yeah. But she knows that Sherlock is a dick. She knows this. She knows that he's an arrogant jerk. And she writes about it. She's like, he came in today being an arrogant jerk.
Right.
But he flirted with her and made her feel good. And she's like, oh, okay. It's kind of like, cause if you do have a crush on someone that is that powerful, and you will do stupid things because you're like, well, maybe they'll like me just a little bit more. And it's not something that's like good, but it does happen. So it's not unrealistic, I don't think. Her and Jim, I don't know. Obviously, he was using her because he knew he could use her to get to Sherlock, I think.
Which is kind of a real good doppelganger to Sherlock. I mean, both of them are using her, but they're using her for different reasons.
Yes.
I just want Molly to stand up and hit one of them.
I would really like it if Molly was evil, if she turned out to, like, go to the dark side. I think that'd be awesome.
I would be really interested in seeing the fallout for her of the Great Game, you know, when she realizes that both these guys, you know, have been using her, and one of them is a freak, which is bad enough, but one of them is actually a master criminal. You know, how do you deal with that?
Will she find out, though?
Well, I don't think how she couldn't. I don't see how she couldn't.
Well, if they don't, obviously because we don't know how it, like, resolved yet, but I don't think they would publicize this incident because Moriarty is such, like, a criminal mastermind, and he has, like, his hands, like, all over the city and everything. Like, they probably want to keep it on the down low because they know what he's capable of, and maybe they don't want to put anyone else in danger. But because she has contact with him, they may, like, let her know, if only to get information out of her. I don't know.
She could be really useful.
Yeah. It's like, what did you talk about other than Glee? Glee becomes a catalyst for
Oh, dear.
I don't know. I like Molly as a character mostly because she amuses me and I feel really bad for her.
Yeah, but I think the bottom line is that basically every character on the show except for Sherlock and John could do with fleshing out, you know, even Mycroft and Lestrade, as you were saying.
Right.
They're all not really developed. You can see things between the lines and in, you know, looks and what have you, but there's a lot that's not said. There's a lot that's not developed or not fleshed out. So yeah, of course, Moffat and Gatiss could do more.
But we'll have to see what Series 2 holds and see if there's any other knickknacks that they reveal with all of these characters.
Thanks for everyone's questions, and thanks for listening, and we hope you tune in to the next episode of Baker Street Babes.
Yes, it'll probably come quicker than this one did after the third, so look for probably early August, I would say. And don't know the topic yet, it's always an adventure.
Well, I certainly hope we were able to answer some of the questions we got. It was such a big topic that we had this round. And hopefully we didn't upset too many of you.
If you did, you can tweet us or email us. Respond to you. It'll be good fun. So yeah, happy Sherlocking.
Indeedy.
See what I did there? Yeah.
That was awesome. Hello, lovely listeners. This is Jen, and I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to take a moment to ask for your help. When we started the Baker Street Babes podcast, we never dreamed we would become as popular as we have. Episode 3 alone had over 1,000 listeners. In fact, it was so popular, we ran out of our monthly bandwidth in about a week. And in order to keep up with demand, we've had to upgrade our account. This is going to cost us $150 a year to keep the podcast available for free to all of you. Now, this is the part where you can help. We are asking for you to please take a moment to consider donating to our podcast. It doesn't even have to be a substantial amount to help us out. If just 150 of you donate $1, the cost of our bandwidth is covered. And if by chance you are willing to contribute more, great! You're not only helping us out, but you're also helping out fellow listeners. And as a side note for our British and European friends, £1 or €1 equals approximately $1.50. So, even better. And each person who donates will be personally thanked by the Baker Street Babes. Now, to donate to our podcast, please visit our page on Tumblr at bakerstreetbabes.tumblr.com or on our Blogspot page at bakerstreetbabes.blogspot.com. Click on the yellow donate button at the top of the page, and this will take you to PayPal, where you can choose how you would like to contribute. We promise not to bother you for donations on a regular basis, and we sincerely hope you can help us out so we can continue to bring you more Sherlock Holmes. Thank you.
On that account, we want to give a sincere thank you to JWHTweets and Orion, I don't know how to pronounce her Twitter name. They have graciously put forth some money to give us 2 months of bandwidth. I cannot thank you enough. Thank you so, so much. We appreciate it. It's amazing. You guys are absolutely fantastic. So you should definitely check them out on Twitter. It's JWHTweets or Orion. It's Orain. Check them out. Follow them. They are awesome. The Sherlock Holmes Game of Shadows trailer is now out in theaters. It's also available online. The sequel to the Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law Sherlock Holmes will be in theaters in the UK and the USA on the 16th of December, and will be following around the world shortly after, or slightly before, if you're lucky enough. The Netherlands, Singapore, and Thailand all get out on the 15th. BBC Sherlock Series 2 has finished filming on Episode 3, The Reichenbach Fall. They have done a read-through for Episode 1, Scandal in Belgravia, and filming will soon start on that. Just so you all know, we're not going to talk about any spoilers. Yes, we know what happens, obviously, but we're not going to tell you any of sort of like the pictures that have been going around. If you want to find them, they're very easy to find. Just look on Twitter, just look on Flickr, hell, Google it. Some people don't want to know how things are being done, which is fine, whatever. If you do want to know, like I said, just do a quick Google search, you'll find everything you want to know. The trailer for BBC4's The Radigan Enigma is now live online. Benedict Cumberbatch is hosting the program, and it should be available pretty soon on BBC4. We'll keep you updated as we know.
In more Undershaw news, you can now pre-order the book, An Entirely New Country, Arthur Conan Doyle, Undershaw, and the Resurrection of Sherlock Holmes by Alastair Duncan, now on Amazon. Actually, this is extremely important. It's really, really an amazing thing that he has written this book for Undershaw. A summary is, the late 1890s saw Arthur Conan Doyle return to England after several years abroad. His new house, named Undershaw, represented a fresh start, but it was also the beginning of a dramatic decade that saw him fall in love, stand for Parliament, fight injustice, and be awarded a knighthood. However, for his many admirers, the most important event of that decade was the resurrection of Sherlock Holmes, the character he felt had cast a shadow over his life. You can actually follow Alastair Duncan on Twitter, at AlastairD221B. Lovely gentleman. We've chatted a few times. So please go and pre-order this book. It'll help Alastair, and it'll also help Undershaw, which is always extremely important. Thank you.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 221 be mine? Socrates had hemlock, Jesus had the Pharisees. But what I have's in that unborn, this girl in front of me. Houdini took a beating, radiation took Curie. I'd much rather take on those pains and mercy they will be. Cause nothing compares to my blackberry girl, the sweetest, sharpest text of all, covertly ruling the world. Don't know what name she goes by, but I'd love to call her mine. Don't even need her number, cause she's bugged my telephone line. My blackberry girl, my blackberry girl. Sends black cars to fetch me, but she never meets my eye. I ask her out to Chinese, but she doesn't have the time. She's read the files about me, but my love she forgets. There are other girls out there, but I won't give up on my lady, eh? Cause nothing compares to my black girl, the sweetest, sharpest text of all, covertly ruling the world. Don't know what name she goes by, but I'd love to call her mine. Don't even need her number, cause she bugged my telephone line. My blackberry girl, my blackberry girl. Someday when you get a break from this, I'll roll up to the door of MI6. Elections can wait, just come with me on a date. Check my status and you'll see that I'm the one. You're a puzzle I love to solve. A QWERTY key steal you from me, I'm losing my resolve. So fill my heart, I'm falling for you. You're my little coup d'etat, won't you tell me who you are? Cause I love you so, oh my blackberry girl. My heart revolves around you, it makes sense to add the world. Don't know a name to call you, just say I can call you mine. A moniker superfluous when I think of you all the time as my blackberry girl. My blackberry girl. Blackberry girl. like this.